Note the length of the flatware, clearly designed to deposit the food several centimeters down the snout instead of at the front.
Seems odd, Ziora said. I'd assume most species' taste receptors would be at the front of the mouth, on the tongue, or their equivalent.
That does seem to be the general pattern, Thrawn said. It makes me think that their outer rim of teeth was their traditional weapon, and the jaws developed so that they could bite into an enemy without tasting his flesh or blood.
Ziora wrinkled her nose. That's disgusting.
Agreed, Thrawn said. But if we should ever meet them, we would have an idea of their likely tactics. Close-in weaponry, like teeth and knives, should translate into a preference for close-in combat, with long-distance weaponry considered secondary, or even dishonorable.
And a rigid hierarchy with an underlying threat of violence would warn us about with whom and where we negotiate, Ziora said, nodding. Interesting. Okay, where to next?
You want to see more?
Thrawn asked, frowning a little. She shrugged. We've come this far. Might as well make an evening of it.
She quickly came to regret giving him such an open invitation. By the time she called a halt, an hour later, her head was spinning with names, images, and tactical inferences.
Okay, this is all very interesting, she said. But near as I can see, almost all of it is very theoretical. Where we have the alien's history, you could have looked it up and backfilled your analysis to fit it.
I've already said I didn't do that.
But you might have come across something when you were younger and forgotten you'd read it, Ziora pointed out. That's happened to me. And where we don't have any history, we'll probably never know if you're right or wrong.
I see,
Thrawn said, his voice suddenly subdued.
I thought this would be interesting to you. I'm sorry if I wasted your time.
I didn't say that,
Ziora protested, eyeing him as a sudden idea occurred to her.
But I'm a practical person, and when I hear a new theory, I like to give it a test.
Shall we ask the Ascendancy to declare war on someone?
I was thinking a little smaller, she said. Come on.
She headed toward the exit.
Where are we going?
Thrawn asked, as he caught up with her.
My quarters, she said. I do a little wire sculpting in my spare time to relax. You can study it and see how well you can read my personal strategies and tactics.
Thrawn was silent a couple of steps.
Are you assuming we will someday be at war with each other?
Yes, and sooner than you think,
Ziora said with a smile.
Because after you finish, we're going to go downstairs to the dojo and go a couple of rounds.
I see,
Thrawn said.
Stick or unarmed?
Ziora gave him the choice. He chose stick.
Okay,
Ziora said, bouncing a few experimental steps on the mat and swinging the two short sticks in her hands to loosen up her wrists. The lightweight face and chest protectors didn't interfere with her movements, and the soft coat sticks felt sturdy in her hands, with the same weight and balance as actual combat sticks.
And if you found some recordings of my combat sessions, say so now before I call cheats on you.
I've never seen you fight,
Thrawn assured her.
You may choose when the bout is over.
Thank you, Ziora said. And that was your first mistake,
she shouted as she leapt forward. A quick head-ribs-head combo should end the fight before he lost too much of his dignity. Only it didn't. Thrawn blocked all three attacks, putting his sticks up in the right spots and in the right order. Her ribs, head, elbow, feint, ribs combo didn't get through either. Neither did her best feint, feint, hip, ribs, head, feint, stomach. She scowled, taking a step back to regroup and reassess. Beginner's luck, obviously. But it was starting to become a bit worrisome. So far, he was just standing there, casually blocking her attacks, but launching none of his own. But that would change soon enough. Time to crank things up a notch. Get an attack through. Force him to counterattack, or at least make him move his damn feet. She leapt forward again, slipping into a feint rib feint. Only this time, on the second feint, he stopped being passive and made his move. Slipping in through the opening created by the feint, he tapped her stick farther out of line, spun in a tight circle within the gap, and brought his own stick to lightly tap the side of her head protector. Even as she tried to bring both sticks back in at him, he spun again and took a long step out of her reach. She leapt forward, trying to get to him while his back was still turned, but he was faster, turning to face her and again blocking her double attack. Again she backed off, taking the opportunity to gulp in a few lungfuls of air. Thrawn didn't follow, but remained where he was. Clearly, her preferred combat techniques weren't working. Time to switch it up a bit. Just because she liked these tactics best didn't mean she hadn't been taught others. Taking one final breath, she again charged. Only this time, instead of using the feint attack combinations, she came straight at him, jabbing forward with both sticks, one aimed at his face, the other at his chest. He blocked the first, but the second slammed into his chest protector with a thoroughly satisfying thud. She moved forward, cocking her arms to do it again. Again, Thrawn was faster. He backed up rapidly, putting himself out of range. She took another step forward, jabbing again and again. One of the two attacks got through. One more, she decided, and she would call the match. She stepped forward and abruptly found herself in the midst of a flurry of flashing sticks as he leapt to the attack. This time it was her turn to back up, cursing silently as she blocked and parried and tried to turn the attack against him. But he wasn't giving her any opening. Her feet felt the change in the texture of the mat, warning that she was getting close to the edge. Thrawn saw it too. He came to a halt, allowing her to slow her own retreat before she could slam into the wall. Another mistake. The pause was just long enough for her to take back the initiative, and once again, she charged at him. He backed up slowly, clearly once more on the defensive. But to her chagrin, her attacks were once again going nowhere as he blocked every feint and thrust. She broke off the attack and stepped back. And for a long moment, they stood facing each other. Before he lost too much of his dignity, her earlier smug thought rose back to mock her.
Is there any point to continuing?
She asked. Thrawn shrugged.
Your choice.
For a long moment, pride and determination urged her to keep going. Common sense won out.
How?
She asked, lowering her sticks and walking up to him.
Your sculptures show your fondness for wide-spaced combinations, Thrawn said, lowering his own sticks to his sides. Particularly 3- and 4-coil patterns. Your favorite subjects, ground lions, dragonnels, and predator birds, indicate the short attacks, hesitation feints, and aggression. The particular shape of open areas shows how you compose your feints, and the angular style suggests a spinning attack would be unexpected and disconcerting enough to slow your response. Which, she remembered, had been his first successful attack.
Interesting, Ciara said.
But what followed was equally instructive, Thrawn continued. He raised his eyebrows slightly in obvious invitation. Ciara felt a flush of irritation. She was the upperclassman here, not him. If there was anyone who should be reciting lessons and offering analysis, it should be him, not her. Which was, she instantly realized, about the stupidest thought she'd ever had in her life. Only a fool passed up an opportunity to learn.
I realized you'd figured out my pattern and changed tactics, she said. And it worked, at least for a couple of attacks. Then you attacked, and after that I was never able to get through again.
Do you know why?
Ciara frowned, thinking back over the fight.
I went back to my old tactics, she said with a wry smile. The ones you'd already figured out how to beat.
Exactly, Thrawn said, smiling back. A lesson for all of us. In moments of stress or uncertainty, we tend to fall back on the familiar and comfortable.
Yes, Ciara murmured,
suddenly noticing where she was relative to him, well within attack range. And she'd never explicitly stated the bout was over. The moment of temptation passed. Just because she hadn't officially stopped, it didn't mean it would be fair to unilaterally start it up again. Thrawn had behaved honorably. She could do no less.
And the care you put into the sculptures shows you have too much honor to play shoddy tricks against a sparring partner, Thrawn added. Ciara felt her face warm.
You sure of that?
Yes.
For a long moment, she was again tempted. Then, spinning on her heel, she stalked across the mat and returned her sticks to the weapons rack.
Okay,
she said over her shoulder as she started pulling off her sparring armor.
I'm impressed. You really think you can do the same thing with alien cultures and tactics?
I do, Thrawn said. Someday, I hope I'll have the chance to prove it.
Chapter 6.
Five hours after the Springhawk went into hiding, Thrawn and Thalia strapped themselves into one of the cruiser's shuttles and headed across the asteroid cluster toward the dark space station floating in the distance.
The journey may be a bit tedious, Thrawn warned as they moved between the floating rocks and dust. We'll be using the maneuvering jets exclusively in order to avoid any thruster plumes that our adversaries might detect. That makes for a slower trip.
I understand, Thalia said.
Still, it gives us a chance to talk in private,
Thrawn continued.
How are you finding your job as caregiver?
It's challenging,
Thalias admitted, a quiet warning bell going off in the back of her mind. Thrawn could have called her into his office at any point since leaving the Ascendancy if he just wanted to talk in private.
Did he know about that last-minute conversation with Thurfian and the deal the Syndicate had forced on her? Ciri's pretty easy to live with, but there are some things every Skywalker deals with that can be difficult.
Nightmares.
And headaches and occasional mood swings, Thalia said, along with just being a 9-year-old.
Especially one who's vital to the functioning of the ship. And knows it.
Right. The horror stories of Skywalker arrogance and demands,
Thalia said scornfully.
Pure ice cap legend. I've never met anyone who's actually seen that happen. Every Skywalker I've known has gone the opposite direction.
Feelings of inadequacy, Thrawn said. The fear that she won't measure up to what her captain and ship require.
Thalias nodded. Like the nightmares, those were feelings she remembered all too well.
Skywalkers are always worried that they'll get the ship lost or do something else wrong.
Though the record indicates very few such incidents, Thrawn said. And most of the affected ships eventually returned safely via jump by jump. He paused. I presume Ciri isn't facing any challenges that you yourself didn't also have to overcome.
No,
Thalias said with a quiet sigh. She really hadn't expected Thrawn to let her aboard without checking up on her. But she'd still sort of hoped he'd somehow miss the fact that she'd once been a Skywalker.
Aside from the whole flying into possible danger part.
Danger is an implicit part of what we do.
Except that you all volunteered for this life, Thalias said. We Skywalkers weren't given that choice.
Thrawn was silent a moment.
You're right, of course, he said. The greater good of the Ascendancy is the rationale. Also the truth, of course, but the fact remains.
It does,
Thalias said.
For what it's worth, I don't think any of us begrudges our service. I mean, aside from the fears and nightmares and all. And the Ascendancy does need us.
Perhaps, Thrawn said.
She frowned at him.
Just perhaps?
A conversation for another day,
Thrawn said.
Display 4. Do you see it?
She turned her attention to the control panel in front of them. Display 4.
That one?
Centered in the display was a small heat source. A heat source coming from an orbital position near the system's inhabited planet. A heat source, the computer calculated, was coming directly toward them.
They've spotted us, she breathed,
her heart suddenly thudding in her throat.
Perhaps, Thrawn said, still sounding thoughtful. The timing certainly suggests that, as it was only 30 seconds ago that the ship ran its thrusters to this level of power.
It's coming straight toward us, she said,
feeling a sudden surge of claustrophobia in the cockpit's tight grasp. They were in a shuttle, not a combat ship, with no weapons, no defenses, and all the maneuverability of a fen slug.
What do we do?
That may depend on who they are and where they're going, Thrawn said.
Thalias frowned at the display.
What do you mean? They're coming toward us, aren't they?
They could also be heading toward the Springhawk, Thrawn said. Or possibly, it's merely a scheduled run to the mining station, and the timing is purely coincidental. At that distance, and at this point in their path, it's impossible to more precisely define their ultimate endpoint.
So what do we do? Thalias asked. Can we get back to the Springhawk in time?
Possibly, Thrawn said. The more immediate question is whether we want to.
Whether we want to?
Thalias repeated, staring at him.
We came here to find out if this is the origin point of the doomed refugees, Thrawn reminded her. My intent was to study the mining station, but a direct conversation would be quicker and more informative.
Only if they don't shoot us on sight.
They might try, Thrawn said.
Tell me, have you ever fired a Charik?
Thalias swallowed hard.
I practice with one a few times at the range, she said. But always on low power, never on high.
There's not much operational difference between those settings.
Thrawn tapped a few keys on his console.
Well, unless the ship increases its speed in the next 2 hours, we should arrive at the station 20 to 30 minutes ahead of it.
What if it's aiming for the Springhawk?
Thalias asked.
Shouldn't we warn them?
I'm sure Mid-Captain Simakro has already noted them, Thrawn assured her.
even if they've spotted the Springhawk, and there's a good chance they haven't. I think there's a way to make sure our visitors stop by the station first.
How?
Thrawn smiled. We invite them in.
The mining station was equipped with several docking ports grouped together at various points around its surface. One cluster included two of the so-called universal ports that many species in the region had adopted over the centuries to accommodate varying sizes of ships. Thrawn docked the shuttle with one of them, waited until the BioClear system had run the usual toxin-slash-biohazard check on the station's air, then led the way inside. Thalias had expected the place to smell old and musty, perhaps with the pungent scent of rotted food, or worse, rotted bodies. But while there was a definite hint of staleness, it was hardly overwhelming. Whenever the owners of the station had pulled out, they'd apparently done so in an orderly fashion.
"This is the place,"
Thrawn said softly, shining his light into alcoves and rooms as they walked down a wide corridor.
"This is where they came from."
"The refugee ships?"
Thalias asked.
"Yes,"
Thrawn confirmed.
"The style is unmistakable."
Thalias said. She'd looked at everything he had, and she didn't have a clue as to what he was picking up on.
"What now?"
"We go to the main control center," Thrawn said, picking up his pace. "That's where our visitors are most likely to dock."
"How are we going to find it?"
"We've passed two floor schematics on the walls since we left the shuttle," Thrawn said, frowning slightly at her. "The main command and control centers were obvious."
Thalias made a face. "Not just one floor schematic, but two of them?" Okay, so maybe she hadn't seen everything he had. They found the control center exactly where Thrawn had predicted it would be. The controls and consoles were labeled with an unfamiliar script, but everything seemed laid out in a logical pattern. A little trial and error with the controls, and suddenly the room blazed with light.
"That's better,"
Thalias said, putting away her own light.
"What now?"
"This,"
Thrawn said, throwing a few more switches.
"If I've read the console organization correctly, we should have now turned on the station's external lights."
Thalias stared at him.
"You... but that ship will see us!"
"I told you I was going to invite them in," Thrawn reminded her. "More important, our lights will hopefully distract them from the Springhawk, should its hiding place have been their original destination."
"I see,"
Thalias said, freshly aware of the Charik riding her hip.
"You're not expecting to fight them, are you?"
"I'm hoping to avoid that, yes,"
Thrawn said.
"The equipment bay with the largest docking ports is at the port side edge of the station. We'll wait for them there."
With a final look around the control center, he headed for a hatch leading in that direction. Taking a few deep, calming breaths, Thalias followed. The equipment bay was larger than Thalias had expected, though with the cranes, maneuvering lifters, overhead cables, and lines of tool and part racks, there was also less open space than she'd anticipated. She and Thrawn had just settled themselves in front of the main port when there was a wheeze of vented air, and the port began to cycle.
"Here they come,"
she muttered, peering past Thrawn's shoulder as he stood in front of her, partially blocking her view.
"They hold their females in high esteem,"
Thrawn had said of the aliens they were tracking. If he was right, his protective position in front of her would hopefully connect to that cultural bias.
"Yes."
Thrawn paused, his head cocked as if listening. Then, to Thalias' surprise, he slipped around behind her, reversing their original positions so that she was now in front.
"What are you doing?"
she demanded, a fresh sense of vulnerability flooding into her. The people about to come in, and whatever weapons they might be carrying... The hatch dilated, and four creatures emerged. Medium height, chest and hip bulges, pink skin, feathery head crests. Exactly like the bodies Thrawn had brought aboard the Springhawk from the second refugee ship. He had indeed found them. For a moment, the two groups eyed each other. Then, one of the newcomers spoke, his voice gravelly, his words incomprehensible. "Do you speak Minasir?" Thrawn called back in that trade language. The alien spoke again, still using his own speech.
"Do you speak Ta'aja?"
Thrawn asked, switching to that one. There was a short pause. Then one of the other aliens took a step forward.
"I speak this,"
he said.
"What do y'all do here?"
"We are explorers," Thrawn said. "My name is Thrawn."
He nudged Thalias.
"Tell them your name."
"I am Thalias,"
Thalias said, taking the cue and giving only her core name. For whatever reason, Thrawn apparently didn't want to give out their full names. The alien's eyes widened and bulged a little as he seemed to study her.
"You are female."
"I am,"
Thalias said. The alien gave a whinnying sort of snort.
"So do you, Thrawn, then hide behind your female."
"Not at all," Thrawn said. "I'm shielding her with my body from those you sent to shoot us in the back."
Thalias caught her breath.
"You're joking, right?"
she muttered. She sensed him shake his head.
"I felt the shift in the air as they entered the secondary hatch behind us." Thalias nodded to herself.
Just as he'd quickly absorbed the feel of the Tamra all those years ago, he'd now just as quickly grasped the same details of this alien station.
"We plan no violence,"
the alien spokesman said hastily.
"Merely caution. Your arrival was unexpected, and we were concerned for our safety."
"I apologize in turn for our startlement of you," Thrawn said. "We thought this station was abandoned. That is why we came."
The alien gave another whinny, a shorter one this time.
"If you sought to build a home here, you chose unwisely. Even now, it may be too late for you to reverse that error."
"We did not come to live," Thrawn said. "As I said, we are explorers. We search the chaos for artwork of the lost and forgotten."
The mottling pattern of the alien's skin changed.
"You search for artwork."
"Artwork reflects the soul of a species," Thrawn said. "We seek to preserve that echo for those unable to preserve it on their own."
One of the other aliens spoke in their language.
"He speaks that there is no artwork here,"
the spokesman translated.
"Perhaps there is more art woven into the design than he realizes," Thrawn said. "But I am puzzled. I see no evidence of catastrophe or destruction. On the contrary, the station appears completely functional. Why did you abandon it?"
"We did not abandon it,"
the spokesman said, his voice noticeably deeper.
"We were sent away by those who seek dominance over Rapak and the Pakosh."
"Rapak is your world, then?" Thrawn asked. "And you are the Pakosh?"
"We are, at least for this current moment," the Bakash may yet cease to exist. The future of each and every Buck rests in the hands of the Nicardoon, and we fear to contemplate it.
The Nicardoon are those who followed us across your system? Thrawn asked. Another whinny.
If you believe they merely followed you, your ignorance is indeed deep. Their intent was to capture or destroy you.
Thalias felt a shiver run up her back. As far as she could remember, she'd never heard even a hint of information about a species with that name. Definitely outside the immediate neighborhood, and very likely outside even the wider region the expansionary fleet had explored. And if this was how they introduced themselves, blocking access to whole systems and chasing down and slaughtering anyone who succeeded in leaving, they weren't likely to become friends of the Ascendancy anytime soon.
Yet they must hold you and your world in loose hands, she pointed out, the angular Ta'arja words hurting her mouth.
Ta'arja had been her least favorite trade language during her schooling, but the Myth family insisted that their merit adoptives learn all the region's most common forms of communication.
Otherwise, how are you here, speaking with us?
You think we traveled here for our own free will?
The spokesman asked, ducking his head just a bit toward her.
You think ourselves removed the weapons and defenses from the ship we arrived in? Hardly. The Nicardoon ships guarding the approaches to Rapak did not recognize the design of your ship. They thought this station might still have sensors running that may have gleaned important details when your ship passed nearby. We were ordered here to learn if such records were indeed made.
Were they correct?
Thrawn asked.
Correct about the sensors?
The spokesman paused, his eyes flicking between them.
Why do you ask? Do you wish the details of your ship to remain secret?
It is said there are those who can deduce the origin of a ship from its design and style of flight, Thrawn said. The unknown leader of these Nicardoon may be one such.
Their leader is hardly unknown,
the Pock said, a hint of disgust in his tone.
General Yiv the Benevolent has personally come to Rapak to speak his demands to and share his gloatings with our leaders.
Such actions speak of supreme confidence, Thrawn said. Will he return soon?
I do not know,
the Pock said.
But more Nicardoon will surely come. And if we are not compliant with the orders of those currently here, it will go badly for us.
And if the Pakash failed to capture the strangers who'd blown past the sentry ships and sneaked aboard their station, Thalias suspected, things would probably go even worse.
What are you going to do with us?
She asked. The spokesman turned back to the others, and for a moment they all consulted together.
Well done, Thrawn said quietly.
What do you mean?
Thalias asked.
That question was better coming from you than from me, he said. Their consideration for females may modify their answer and influence their decision in our favor.
And if it doesn't?
Then the Jarix,
Thrawn said, his voice calm but determined.
You'll deal with those in front of us. I'll do likewise with the ones behind.
Thalias' mouth went suddenly dry.
You mean just shoot them down?
We are two, Thrawn said. They are four. plus however many are currently unseen and unnumbered behind us. If they decide to take us prisoner, our only chance will be immediate and lethal attack.
A cold chill ran up Thales' back. Getting pulled into a firefight, shooting and being shot at, had been a terrifying prospect. But at least she could have gone into a heated battle with a mostly clear conscience. What Thrawn was talking about was straight-up, cold-hearted murder. The Pakosh ended their discussion.
We have no orders regarding intruders. We were sent only to examine the sensors.
The other alien said a few words.
But we presume the Nikar Dune would have required your capture if they had known you were here.
Perhaps, Thrawn said. The more important question is, what do the Pakosh require?
The spokesman turned to the others. Thalias lifted her hand to her hair, pretending to adjust a few strands, hopefully drawing a bit of extra attention to herself.
If you allow us to depart, I will make sure the Nikar Dune do not detect us,
Thrawn added into the silence.
How can you be sure of that?
They did not detect our arrival at this place, Thrawn said. I doubt they will be more attentive now.
Surely they saw you turn on the station lights.
Surely you can remotely activate those systems,
Thrawn countered. The spokesman considered, then inclined his head.
Yes, we can.
He hissed out a breath.
The commander has decided. You may leave in peace.
Thalias let her own breath out in a silent sigh of relief.
Thank you,
she said.
You have not yet answered my earlier question,
Thrawn said.
Are the station sensors still operating?
The spokesman whinnied.
In weeks past, the Nikar Dune ordered us to shut down the station before abandoning it, with the lives of each and every Puck lying beneath their sword. We obeyed our orders to the letter. There are no functioning sensors.
That is well, Thrawn said. Farewell, then. And may you yet find freedom and peace.
Touching Thalias' arm, he nodded back toward the hatchway that would return them to their shuttle.
Wait!
Thalias turned back. The Pak who'd done all the non-Ta'arja speaking earlier, the one she tentatively identified as the group's leader, was walking toward them. She started to take a step backward, stopped as Thrawn again touched her arm.
This is Ween Gully,
the spokesman said, as the Pak stopped in front of Thrawn.
He has something he wishes to give you.
For a moment, Ween Gully stood motionless. Then, with clear reluctance, he lifted both hands in front of him, one hand tugging at the fingers of the other. A moment later, he'd slid a double ring off two of the fingers, the twin circlets connected by a short, flexible mesh. Another moment of hesitation, and he held the double ring toward Thrawn.
Ween Gully Fua Ma Oksa,
he said.
The double ring is a prized heirloom of the Mar'aksa subclan,
the spokesman said quietly.
Ween Gully wishes you to take it and add it to your artwork that the subclan and the Mar'aksa people will not be forgotten.
For the first time since Thalias had met him, Thrawn seemed genuinely surprised. He looked at Ween Gully, then at the rings, then at Ween Gully again. Then he held out his hand, palm upward.
Thank you, he said. I will guard it in a place of honor.
Wingali lowered his head in a bow as he placed the double ring in Thrawn's hand. He straightened up, turned, and walked back toward the other Pakosh. They turned in unison as he passed them, and all four headed through the hatchway. There was a brush of air behind Thalias, and she jerked as three other Pakosh, apparently Wingali's backup force, walked silently past the two Chiss and joined their comrades. They all disappeared from sight, the hatch closing behind them. Thalias peered at the double ring in Thrawn's palm. It was made of a silvery metal, with a series of curved arcs embossed on the base. A cluster of what looked like small snakes rose from the center of the arcs, flanked by two much larger snakes that curved up and around, crossing each other once, and ending with their heads and open mouths pointed defiantly upward. She was still studying the rings when the lights around them abruptly went out.
What?
Oh, she added belatedly. Remote controls.
Wingali reinforcing the illusion for any Nick-Hardoon observers, Thrawn said as he flicked on his own light. Come.
He turned and strode toward the hatchway.
We're heading back already?
Thalias asked as she hurried to keep up with him.
We have everything Supreme General Barkeev sent us to find, Thrawn said. The murdered refugees were Pakosh from the Rapak system. Their oppressors are called the Nick-Hardoon, and the Nick-Hardoon leader is General Yiv the Benevolent. He seemed to consider. Plus, perhaps a few additional facts that Barkeev wasn't expecting.
Such as?
Thrawn was silent for another few steps.
We located the Pakosh partly because the refugee ship came from this general direction. We also presume that the Nick-Hardoon followed them, or in some other way, anticipated their arrival in the Ascendancy. Then ordered the attack on Chila in order to distract our attention from the Pakosh destruction.
Thalias nodded.
That makes sense.
But that leads to another question, Thrawn said. How did the Nick-Hardoon know to stage their ambush at that particular spot?
Well,
Thalias paused, trying to think it through.
We know the two Pakian ships rendezvoused in the four-star system before the one ship headed for the Ascendancy. Maybe the captain decided we were their best shot at getting help, especially with one of the two ships unable to keep going. Don't know how they knew where we were, though.
Many of the aliens out here know about us, or at least have a general idea where we are,
Thrawn said.
Though our reputation often precedes any actual knowledge. You'll note the Pakosh didn't seem to recognize that we were Chiss. But you miss the critical point of my question. The refugee ship left hyperspace much farther out in the system than was necessary. Far enough that they would have needed several hours of space normal travel before they were even close enough to initiate communication.
He paused.
And far enough that while their slaughter was detected, there was no chance that any of the patrol ships could respond in time.
Thalias breathed a curse as it suddenly became clear. The only way the Nick-Hardoon could be waiting for the ship is if the refugee's navigator deliberately brought them out of hyperspace there. She frowned. They did have a navigator, didn't they?
I assume so, Thrawn said. Presumably a void guide, like the second ships. Note also the fact that we found no such body aboard the first ship.
He paused again, clearly expecting Thalias to follow his path of logic.
The Nick-Hardoon took him with them?
She offered.
Indeed, Thrawn said. Was he dead or alive?
Thalias chewed at her lip.
How was she supposed to know that?
For that matter, Why was Thrawn even going through this logic puzzle with her? Especially this way. It was like the schoolwork classes she'd had to take as an occasionally reluctant Skywalker, or the same classes she was now having to inflict on an even more reluctant Chiri.
The Pakash aboard the other ship died much later than those who were attacked in the Ascendancy, he prompted.
Thalias nodded as she finally saw where he was going, especially since the second group had asphyxiated instead of being murdered like the first group.
He was dead, she said. If he'd been alive, he'd have told the Nicardoon where the other ship was, and they'd have moved in and slaughtered them too, instead of letting them die on their own.
Excellent, Thrawn said. We also gleaned the fact that it was the Bakash, not the Void Guides, who chose the four-star system as their rendezvous.
Okay,
Thalias said, frowning.
How does that help us?
It may not, Thrawn conceded. But sometimes small bits of knowledge return in unexpected ways.
He gestured ahead.
At any rate, I believe we've learned all that we're going to here. A stealthy return to the Springhawk is now in order, followed by a hopefully unimpeded exit from the system.
The Nicardoon will be watching,
Thalias warned.
Agreed,
Thrawn said.
But after the Vigilance incursion, I expect the Nicardoon will have pulled their sentry lines closer into the inner system. Our escape should be straightforward, as should our rendezvous with the Vigilant to retrieve our Skywalker.
And then back to the Ascendancy?
Thrawn looked down at the double ring in his hand.
Not right away, he said. No. I think we'll go to a Navigator's Guild concourse and hire ourselves a navigator.
Thalias frowned.
You already said we'll have Chiri.
In case we need her, Thrawn said. But the Pakash indicated there may be more Nicardoon ships arriving in the near future. There's something I want to do before that happens.
Ah,
Thalias said carefully. Unless the fleet had changed the rules since she was a Skywalker, a captain who wanted to expand the scope of a mission was supposed to first get authorization. But that really wasn't any of her business.
You're looking for a Void Guide?
No,
Thrawn said. He fingered the ring one last time, then put it carefully into a pocket.
No. I think there's someone who will be far more useful to us.
Memories 5. Chiss diplomatic cruiser coming in.
Pathfinder dispatcher Prak called above the buzz of conversation filling the Navigator's Guild lounge.
Who wants it?
The conversation broke off like a door had slammed shut over it, and everyone did their best imitation of being somewhere else, including Kilori of Yuan Jualan. He sat unmoving on his bench, his shoulders hunched, still gripping the rim handle of his mug. Chiss. Just his pathetic luck to be on duty when a chiss rolled in.
Kilori, where are you?
The dispatcher continued.
Come on, Kilori. I know you're here.
He's over here.
Someone two tables over called helpfully. Kilori sent the other navigator a glare.
Yeah, I'm here,
he growled.
Good for you,
the dispatcher said.
Grab your headset, sash up, and sashay down. Your turn for the hotbox.
Yeah.
Kilori growled again, his cheek winglet snapping flat against the sides of his head with disgust as he stood up and crossed the room to the dispatcher. The other Pathfinders wanted to jeer at his dirt assignment, he knew. He'd certainly done his share of jeering when the situation was flipped, but none of them dared. Prak wasn't above changing assignments at the last second if someone higher on his gripe list caught his eye.
So where are they going?
He asked.
Bardram scoffed,
the dispatcher said.
What are they going there for?
Don't know, don't care. Board gate 5. 15 minutes.
He gave Kilori a smirking smile.
Have fun!
15 minutes later, his travel bag slung over his shoulder, Kilori watched the boarding gate swing open, and a couple of black-uniformed blueskins stepped out.
You our Pathfinder?
One of them asked in the Minisiat trade language. At least this bunch weren't expecting everyone else in the chaos to speak Chiyun.
I am,
Kilori said, waving a hand over his ID sash.
I am Kilori of Yuan Jualan. I'm a class 5.
Yes, fine,
the blueskin said.
Come on, be in a hurry.
He turned and strode back through the gate. Kilori followed, silently cursing Prak for dropping this assignment on him. No one out here liked the Chiss. At least no one Kilori had ever met who'd worked with them liked them. It wasn't just that they considered themselves better than everyone else. Most species had that delusion, after all. No, it was that the Chiss didn't seem to think there was even anyone else out here for them to feel superior to. They had a strange and infuriating blind spot where the rest of the chaos was concerned, as if every other species was entirely composed of particularly clever animals, or else had been brought into existence solely for the Ascendancy's benefit. They barely saw anyone. They certainly didn't care about anyone. The bridge was pretty much the same as on every other Chiss merchant ship and diplomatic cruiser Kilori had seen. Small and efficient, with helm, navigation, defense, and comm consoles. The captain was seated in a chair behind the helm and nav consoles, with other Chiss at all but the nav position. That seat, of course, was Kilori's.
Pathfinder,
the captain said, nodding in greeting.
As soon as you've taken your place, we'll be off.
Kilori's cheek winglets flattened as he sat down and flexed his fingers over the controls. Right. Have fun. The trip was uneventful. On the captain's command, Kilori put on his sensory deprivation headset and slipped into his trance, letting the great presence whisper into and around and through him. As usual, the great presence was miserly with its wisdom and insights, making for a somewhat slower trip than Kilori would have liked. Fortunately, the space in this part of the chaos was relatively smooth, with only a few of the anomalies that made navigators like the Pathfinders necessary for long-range interstellar travel. They reached Bardram Scoffed a few minutes ahead of the captain's proposed schedule, and in a whole lot less time than a jump-by-jump trip would have taken. All in all, Kilori decided as he slipped off his headset, he'd earned his pay. He blinked away the post-trance cobwebs, flexing the stiffness out of his fingers. The planet loomed large in the viewport as the ship settled into orbit. The bridge had mostly emptied out, with only Kilori and a pilot still there.
Where is everyone?
He asked.
Preparing the ambassador for the welcoming ceremony, the pilot said. Scoftic culture requires the highest-ranking military officer to accompany the ambassador, and there may be other protocols to be observed.
Maybe?
Kilori asked, frowning as he scanned the sky. There were a lot of ships out there, more than he'd ever seen at a backwater world like this.
I thought you just like to be prepared for everything ahead of time.
We do, the pilot said. The Skofti government has changed again, and with it, the protocols. Our ambassador must relearn them.
Ah,
Kilori said. So that was it. New government, and everybody nearby had sent emissaries to offer their best wishes and size up the newcomer.
I didn't know the old prefect had been unwell.
He wasn't, the pilot said. He was assassinated. What ship is that?
What?
Kilori said, his winglets fluttering with surprise. Assassinated?
But everyone's okay with that?
It's not unheard of among the Skofti, the pilot said calmly. That ship, what nation does it represent?
Kilori peered out the viewport, still struggling at the casualness of it all.
I think it's a Leoaoan.
Is it a new design?
I don't know. How should I know?
You're a navigator, the Chiss said. You see many ships from many nations.
Yes, but I mostly only see the insides,
Kilori said, frowning.
Why the sudden interest?
That vessel shows many of the same characteristics as a group of pirate ships that have been attacking freighters at the outer edges of the Chiss Ascendancy.
Really?
Kilori asked, trying to sound surprised. There were dark rumors among the various navigator groups that the Leoaoan regime had turned to piracy to prop up their failing economy. Most of the stories came from the Void Guides, who did more work in that particular region. But he'd heard a couple of his fellow Pathfinders talking about it too. He couldn't tell the pilot that, of course. The Navigators Guild rules of confidentiality and neutrality were unbreakable.
Sounds pretty unlikely.
You don't believe a pirate group would buy their ships from a local manufacturer?
Oh,
Kilori said, feeling a slight sense of relief. So the Chiss wasn't even thinking that the Leoaoi were officially involved.
No, I see what you mean. I suppose that's possible.
Yes, the pilot said. Have you ever traveled to the Leoaoan space?
Once or twice, yes.
You could find your way there again.
From the Chiss Ascendancy? Of course. I could find my way to any system you wanted. That's what navigators do.
The Leoaoan regime will do for now, the pilot said. Suppose I wanted to approach from a different direction than the Ascendancy. Say, from here, at Bardram Skoft.
Are we heading there?
The pilot gazed out the viewport for another moment.
Not yet, he said, his voice thoughtful. Perhaps later. What's your name?
Kilori, of Yuan Jualan,
Kilori said, frowning. Where was the Chiss going with this line of questioning?
Are you normally to be found at the Navigators Guild station where we hired you?
I move around a lot between the various guild stations,
Kilori said.
Obviously. But Concourse 447 is my official base station, yes?
Good, the Chiss said. Perhaps we shall work together in the future.
That would be wonderful,
Kilori said, studying the Chiss's profile. Few of them even bothered to learn his name, let alone want to know how to find him. Fewer still would bother to study another species' ship design. Who was this Chiss, anyway?
And your name?
He asked.
In case you specifically asked for me.
Junior Commander Thrawn, the Chiss said softly. And yes, I shall most definitely ask for you.
Chapter 7. Kilori had never expected the Chiss named Thrawn to ever blacken his sky again. He'd certainly hoped he wouldn't. But yet here he was, back at Guild Concourse 447, asking specifically for Kilori of Yuan Jualan. And a senior captain now to boot. Kilori didn't know a lot about Chiss military ranks and promotion schedules, but he had the distinct impression that Thrawn was younger than most Chiss who'd achieved that rank. Considering what had happened at Kynos a few years ago, he supposed he shouldn't be too surprised.
It's good to see you again, Kilori of Yuan Jualan, Thrawn said, as Kilori was ushered onto the bridge.
Thank you,
Kilori said, looking around. He'd never been on a Chiss warship before, and the difference between this and his usual freighter and diplomatic cruiser assignments was like the difference from sweet to sour. Weapons boards, defense boards, status panels, multiple displays, a full complement of black uniformed blueskins.
Are you familiar with the Rapak system? Thrawn asked.
Kilori jerked his attention back from the lights and displays, fighting to keep his cheek winglets still. Rapak? That was one of the places Yiv the Benevolent had under blockade, wasn't it?
Yes, he was sure of it.
Kilori didn't know Yiv's final plan, whether the Benevolent would directly annex the system or leave the Pakash as tributaries. But either way, the Nicardoon were certainly already there. What in the Great Presence's name did Thrawn want with Rapak?
Pathfinder, Thrawn prompted.
Abruptly, Kilori remembered he'd been asked a question.
Yes, I know the system,
he said, again trying to keep his winglets steady.
Difficult to get into. Nothing very interesting once you do.
You might be surprised, Thrawn said.
At any rate, that's our destination. He gestured to the navigator station.
At your convenience.
There was nothing for it. Guild rules apart, Kilori could hardly tell Thrawn that the Nicardoon would be as happy to cut a Chiss warship to ribbons as they would any other unwelcome intruder. Apart from all the other considerations, a warning like that might prompt Thrawn to wonder how Kilori knew so much about Yiv and the Nicardoon, and where he'd learned it. So Kilori would take the Chiss to Rapak as ordered, and he would hope to the Great Presence that the system's Nicardoon overseer would take the time to pull the valuable and totally innocent Pathfinder out of the wreckage before ordering the ship's final destruction. He would hope it very, very much. The bridge was quiet as Simakro came in, with only the command, helm, primary weapons, and primary defense stations occupied. Plus, of course, the alien Pathfinder sitting at the navigation station, and the two Charak-armed guards standing on either side of the hatch, keeping a watchful eye on him. Mid-Commander Elo Dalvamik was seated in the command chair, her fingers tapping noiselessly and restlessly on the armrest as she gazed through the viewport at the undulating hyperspace sky. She looked up as Simakro came alongside her.
Mid-Captain, she greeted him.
Mid-Commander, Simakro greeted her in turn. Anything to report?
The Pathfinder came out of his trance again an hour ago, took a 10-minute break, then went back under his headset,
Dalvu said.
He said another 3-hour shift should bring us to Rapak. We took a location reading while we were in space normal, and it looked like we were in the right position.
I presume you reported all this to the captain?
Dalvu's shoulders gave a small twitch.
I sent him the message. Whether or not he noticed is something you'd have to ask him.
Simakro felt his eyes narrow. A disrespectful comment that managed to be not quite over the line into something actionable. Dalvu wasn't the type to come up with such opinions on her own, let alone have the audacity to speak them. Apparently, Carol had been sharing his displeasure regarding the new command structure with his fellow officers.
I believe you'll find Captain Thrawn on top of the situation, he told her. Hold things as is for another hour, then start bringing the Springhawk to combat status. I want us at full battle.
Combat status?
Dalvu cut him off, her eyes going wide.
We're going into combat?
I'll want us at full battle stations 30 minutes before we reach Rapak,
Simakro finished.
but combat?
Probably, Simakro said. Why? Did you think we had some other reason for going back to Rapak?
Dalvu's lips curved in an almost scowl.
I assumed Captain Thrawn forgot something and we were going back to get it.
Simakro gazed down at her, counting down 5 seconds of silence. Dalvu's scowl was gone after the first 2 seconds, and by the fifth, she was starting to look distinctly uncomfortable.
I suggest you keep any derogatory thoughts about the captain to yourself, Simakro said quietly. His mental state is not your concern, nor is his fitness to command, nor is his authority to issue orders aboard this vessel. Is that clear, mid-commander?
Yes, sir,
Dalvu said in a more subdued tone.
But are we even authorized to fight these people?
We're always authorized to defend ourselves, Simakro reminded her. And given the blockade ship's reaction on our last incursion, I suspect we won't have to wait very long on that count.
Yes, sir,
Dalvu muttered, lowering her gaze. Simakro pressed his lips together, his annoyance at her reluctantly fading away. Unfortunately, she had a point. They'd been fine on their last run into the system, but that time they'd had a night dragon running backup. Now it was just them.
You weren't aboard the Springhawk back when Thrawn was first in command, were you?
No, sir, Dalvu said. But I've heard stories of his recklessness.
Best to take those with a sideways look,
Simakro advised.
Just because Thrawn doesn't lay out his tactics in advance for everyone to see, doesn't mean he doesn't have them. Whatever he's got planned for today, he'll get us through it.
He took a deep breath and looked again out the viewport.
Trust me.
It was time. The shimmering disk of the Great Presence loomed large in Kilori's unseeing eyes. The undulating rumble echoed in his unhearing ears. Reaching blindly to the hyperdrive lever at his right, he squeezed off the locking bar and wrapped his fingers around the lever. He waited until the disk filled his vision, then delicately pushed the lever forward. He waited another moment, savoring the experience one final time, then shut down the sound-blocking part of his headset. The Great Presence vanished as a quiet hum of Chiss voices filled his ears. He pulled off the headset, blinking as his eyes adjusted to the muted bridge light, and peered through the viewport. They had arrived. Casually, he looked around him. All the stations were occupied, but none of the Chiss seemed to be watching him. Keeping his movements small, he reached into one of the storage pouches built into his ID sash and keyed his comm. He'd spent the last 3 rest periods recording a message for the Nicardoon ships lurking out there, and then figuring out how to tap into the ship's short-range transmitter. A sharp voice from the Chiss at the sensor station cut through the conversational hum. Kilori ran his eyes quickly over the displays, found the tactical one. He felt his cheek winglets flutter. 3 ships were angling in toward the Springhawk, one from starboard, the other 2 from behind. The markings on the display were all in unreadable Chiyun script, but he knew the ships had to be Nicardoon. His winglets fluttered harder. If the attackers had gotten his message, and if the blockade commander decided a Pathfinder was worth saving, they might go easy on their prey, at least until they'd battered most of the life out of it. If the commander wasn't feeling so charitable, Kilori had seen his last star rise. The deck gave a sudden jolt. Kilori jerked in response, fully expecting to see a flash of laser fire or a wall of flame from a missile blaze through the bridge wall. But nothing. He looked at the tactical again, frowning and tensed. The jolt hadn't been a Nick Ardoon attack, but the recoil as a shuttle separated from the Springhawk's flank. Even as he watched, it headed toward the inner system and the planet Rapak at an incredibly high acceleration.
He clenched his teeth.
If Thrawn was hoping whoever was in there would escape, he'd already lost his gamble. The two aft pursuers veered off, accelerating in turn as they chased after the shuttle. Kilori couldn't read the markings on the velocity/intercept curves, but he had no doubt the two Nick Ardoon would catch the craft long before it reached Rapak, or even the relative safety of one of the asteroid clusters. They would catch it, and with a barrage of laser fire, or the more delicate twist of a tractor beam, they would destroy or capture it. On the tactical, he saw that the Springhawk, its errand apparently fulfilled, was now angling away from the inner system and the fleeing shuttle, attempting no doubt to clear the system's collection of orbiting debris and reach a safe hyperspace jump-off point before its remaining pursuer could get into combat range. Kilori eyed the tactical, noting that the Nick Ardoon had put on a burst of speed of his own. He frowned. The remaining pursuer, the last of the three Nick Ardoon ships, had been sitting at the Springhawk's entry point, ready to give battle. A point that Thrawn had deliberately specified out of the handful of safe vectors available. Was it simply bad luck that had brought them to a spot where three Nick Ardoon had been waiting? Maybe. Maybe he just didn't know enough about the system. But in that case, why hadn't he come out of hyperspace much farther out and done at least a quick recon before committing himself and his ship to this vector? At least then he might have found a way or route that would have given his shuttle a better chance of getting somewhere before it was destroyed. A cold chill ran up his back. No, Thrawn couldn't be that short-sighted. Not the Thrawn whose battle tactics Kilori had had the misfortune to see firsthand, which left only one other option. Thrawn had arrived on this particular vector because he wanted the Nick Ardoon to attack him. Kilori looked back and forth among the banks of displays, trying to make sense of it all. Was the Springhawk just a feint? A diversion to let the actual intruder slip into the Rapak system unhindered? Could there be someone out there aiming for the asteroid clusters, maybe? Moving stealthily in the hope that with Nick Ardoon attention focused out here, they wouldn't be spotted until it was too late? But he couldn't see anything like that on any of the displays. No other ships, no other vectors, no indication of anything else in the system. Surely the Chiss would have their own vessels marked, even if they were stealthed and undetectable to the Nick Ardoon, wouldn't they? The pursuing Nick Ardoon patrol ship put on an additional burst of speed. Kilori watched nervously as it finally reached firing range. Abruptly, as if Thrawn had just noticed the threat coming up on his starboard side, the Springhawk made a sharp turn away from its attacker. The pursuing ship opened fire with its spectrum lasers, and a large piece of debris detached itself from the Chiss ship's flank and fell backward. The Springhawk shifted direction just slightly, the Nick Ardoon adjusting its own vector to match. And suddenly, Kilori realized what was going on. The object falling behind the Springhawk wasn't battle debris from the Nick Ardoon attack, as he'd thought. It was, in fact, another of the Chiss ship's shuttles. And the Nick Ardoon, now blasting toward the Springhawk at top speed, was about to run straight into it. Kilori's first horrible thought was that the shuttle would crash into the oversized bridge viewport that marked all of Yiv's combat ships. But the Nick Ardoon captain spotted the obstacle in time to twist the ship aside. Unfortunately, there wasn't time to twist it far enough. The shuttle missed the viewport to slam instead into the portside weapons cluster, wrecking that group of lasers and missile launchers and setting the ship spinning. A second later, the starscape outside the Springhawk's viewport spun crazily as the Chiss ship did its own yaw rotation. Kilori gripped his armrests, fighting against vertigo as the Springhawk's movement brought the stern of the tumbling Nicardoon into view. There was a multiple flash of laser fire, and the fiery yellow glow from the Nicardoon's thruster nozzles flared once and then faded as the damaged engines behind the nozzles shut down. Kilori held his breath, waiting for the salvo that would blast the